If you've driven down Commercial Street here in Portland lately, you will have noticed a large, rather elegant building with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute lettering right across the front. And it's something that I'm sure that you've been a little curious about. So we thought we'd bring in an individual who could tell us all about the Gulf of Maine Research Institute here in Portland. And that is Alan Leishness, who is the Chief Innovation Officer over there. This has been a hard guy to get in to talk with us, so we are very blessed to have you here today.
I'm delighted to be here.
I knew the Gulf of Maine Research Institute when I was much younger, as a student myself. You guys have grown just exponentially since then. Granted, it's been a little while, but you have a new building, you have new programs, you're impacting children all over the state of Maine, and you're impacting adults and ecological programs really all over New England. Maybe an even further reach. This has been an ambitious sort of cycle that you've been working with.
It really has been, and people are sometimes surprised to learn that we were actually incorporated in 1968 as the Research Institute of the Gulf of Maine. Shortly thereafter, we morphed into the Gulf of Maine Aquarium because it was a very interesting time back then. There was kind of the pie is one size. So this Trigom group was very interested in doing marine research in the Gulf of Maine, as was the University of Maine. And there was this perspective at the time, which was a long time ago, 40-some years ago, that whatever work the Research Institute of the Gulf of Maine might have gotten was taking food from the mouths of the hungry children of the professors trying to do that work at the University of Maine. Now is an indicator of how much things have changed. We have a stunning relationship with the University of Maine School of Marine Science, and two of our six research scientists are joint appointments with the university. So that's how much things have changed over a 40-year period. It's a very, very positive development in Maine.
Why the shift from Gulf of Maine Aquarium to Gulf of Maine Research Institute? And tell me what the differences are between the two.
Well, at the time we were interested in building an aquarium, I came on board 26 years ago and was hired for 1 year to raise $6 million to build an aquarium. And it was at a time when some really interesting work was going on with public aquaria around the country. And some were large and very recognizable. Of course, the New England Aquarium in Boston was the first, and then the National Aquarium in Baltimore. But then there were aquariums getting built in smaller cities, one much smaller than Portland, Newport, Oregon. So we were looking at some of those models and saying it would be really interesting to engage people, because before people can learn, you kind of have to engage their attention and find out what they're passionate about. But then as we embarked down that road, we noticed some missing elements in the landscape. And Maine is clearly a place where a whole lot of people can't be trying to do the same thing at once. There's a ton of room for collaboration, but there isn't a whole lot of room, or there isn't a whole lot of funding for flat-out competition. So we said, okay, we have some great colleges and universities in Maine. We're blessed, given our population size, to have the sorts of schools that we do. What's missing? And what we discovered was there wasn't much going on in K-12 science education. We were doing a few projects as the Gulf of Maine Aquarium, and teachers were saying, more, give us more, we want more. We also noticed that there wasn't a focus on applied research around fisheries. There are terrific research institutions in the Gulf of Maine. One that jumps to mind is the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences. And Bigelow works, of course, in the Gulf of Maine, but also oceans around the world. So we said, I wonder if there could be a focus on Gulf of Maine fisheries, because it's a really thorny area. This was, remember, 20 years ago. And then the third space that we were interested in had to do with biotechnological opportunities in the Gulf of Maine. For instance, there's a lot more stuff in the ocean than there is in the rainforest, and we know what's coming out of the rainforest in terms of beneficial compounds, for instance. So we set out to focus on those three areas. Now, we've frankly done a whole lot more on the K-12 education side and on the applied marine fishery side. And we're constantly monitoring the biotech side, but it's not a space that we've gotten into heavily. So that's kind of how we got from there to here, was a gap analysis to understand what wasn't going on in Maine and in the Gulf of Maine.
I heard you speak at a TEDx talk, I think, 2 or 3 years ago now, and you said that you actually have had the ability to touch almost every student that goes through in this area, and I think it was maybe around the middle school years.
Yeah.
What do you do with students who come in and see the Gulf of Maine Research Institute? What is it that you're trying to put out there?
Well, what we're trying to do as an education group at GMRI is over time to cultivate a scientifically literate public. So we see that as happening over a series of related events. We don't begin to think that we as GMRI can do all of that. So there's a ton of collaboration going on with other institutions in the state of Maine. One that immediately pops to mind is the Maine Math and Science Alliance. So let me just back up a little bit to talk about what I mean when we say our goal is to cultivate a science-literate public. Some people say, oh, you have 10,000 kids coming to the Sam L. Cohen Center every year, so your goal is 10,000 marine scientists, right? And the answer is no, not exactly. Our goal is to engage kids around critical thinking, problem solving, collaboration, and communication. Those four skill sets, which are handy not only in a context of workforce development, but also life in a very complex 21st century. When we go to vote now, there are almost always technological and scientific sort of issues that are not too far in the background. And if we're afraid of them, then we're probably going to vote against them. If we understand them, we're more apt to come to a kind of a weighed decision because we do understand them.
The ocean offers us so much more than I think most people realize. We, for a long time, have known that there are fish there. We can eat the fish. We can float our boats in it. I mean, there's industry. But there are also plants growing in the ocean that we know are very good for humans to eat. You know, we're more and more eating what are called sea vegetables. It used to be called seaweed. The interesting thing for me is that this is something that our Irish great-grandmothers knew about somewhere way back when. Are you doing any work in the area of sustainability of food, fish, sea vegetables?
It's so funny that you should ask this question, because when I walked out the door this morning, I met a whole group of people who were at the lab because they had rented space in the lab, and they are a kelp farming group. And the guy I was talking with who ran the company said, when you go back upstairs, can you tell people that those seeds we raised in your lab on the first floor at GMRI resulted in 100,000 pounds of kelp? So yes, we're very, very interested. And one of the things I'll emphasize in our conversation is collaboration. We there's, I don't know, 65, 67 of us. And, you know, there were 1.5 when I started. So that's a lot. But it's still not enough to kind of fulfill our aspirations. So we partner with a lot of organizations in the building. We have a company called Fish Vet, happens to be a Scottish company, that has developed a lot of the work around keeping aquacultured populations healthy. We have a company in the building called Skyr Energy, also completely coincidentally a Scottish company. They're an ocean energy engineering firm, and they're doing the engineering for the Cape Wind offshore project in Massachusetts. We have a company in the building called ImageWorks. They produce very sophisticated software and hardware platforms, in fact, have driven all of our children learning experiences, the design of the platforms, the lab venture experience that we've described that happens in the building. And then two other programs called, one is called Vital Signs, where kids are using their laptops in the 7th and 8th grade to look for the presence or absence of invasive species around the state. And our newest program called Powerhouse, also for 7th and 8th graders, such that students can use their laptops to determine how they're using electricity in their house and how they can better manage the use of that electricity.
And is it this the sort of idea behind a lot of what you're doing is personalizing it so that it becomes less of an abstract idea of the ecosystem and more about an individual's interaction with it?
Absolutely. Think about a 12 or 13-year-old, a 7th or 8th grader, and all over the media, we see warnings about climate change. We see debate. Is it real? Isn't it real? While we have our opinions about that, we're not really interested in the debate. We're interested in how we are going to respond to the obvious changes in the climate. And it's very hard for a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old to be responsive. And so, for instance, that's one of the things that we're getting at with Powerhouse. People often say to us, Gulf of Maine Research Institute, electricity, what does that have to do with anything? Well, of course, what it has to do with is the burning of carbon-based fuels and the deposit of that carbon in the ocean and ocean acidification. So anything with calcium in it, take for instance a lobster shell or a clam shell or a scallop shell, has a real problem with increased acidification. So what we're saying to young people is, you know, you really have a role. By your really understanding how electricity gets used in your home, you can better manage so that, for instance, we're burning less coal and less oil, and we're using our electricity at times of day when we have natural gas available or hydro available or wind available. So it's exactly that. It's to personalize it and to say, hey, you as an individual actually can make a difference, and here's how. And by the way, you've learned some science and some math and some engineering along the way.
You're also trying to impact decision-making when it comes to consumers. You have a work that you're doing with sustainably harvested fish. I was at Sea Glass at Inn by the Sea, and on the menu it said, this fish is certified sustainably harvested by the Gulf of Maine Research Institute.
We have three groups working at JMRI, and probably the most obvious, easiest to understand is our science group. They're trying to come to a deeper foundational understanding about how things are working in the Gulf of Maine, and to your earlier point, elsewhere. Then we have this group called our community group, and they're kind of hard to describe. What they're doing is working with people in a context of neutrality. Now, neutrality is really, really important to GMRI. Take really any issue. Take the issue of fishing. And picture this long arc, and on one end of the arc are perhaps people who would want to take every last fish out of the ocean. Never met that person, but let's just say. And on the other end of the arc are people who don't want to ever see another fish caught. I frankly haven't met those people either, but they probably exist. The point is that organizations tend to be able to be placed anywhere on that arc. And once you're there, you're kind of defined and you've lost a lot of flexibility. So we said, what would be really different would be if we provided a flat table, a neutral table, where we invited all parties. And that it is amazing how it works. It's difficult because as individuals, we all have positions. But as an institution, we don't. And we generally know that we're doing pretty well if every constituency is kind of mad at us about something. It means that we're not over-responding to anyone. So our community group are masters at that neutrality, at welcoming all people. And it's a very informed style of facilitation. You couldn't do it if you didn't know the subject area. And so they, for instance, you describe one of our programs, the Sustainable Seafood Program, and we have a bunch of restaurant partners like Inn by the Sea and like 555 who are looking with us at underutilized species and saying, hey, how could we make that more appealing and interesting? We had a big dinner for our national advisory group last week at 555, and they had a very interesting redfish appetizer on the menu. Because, you know, people who've grown up in Maine remember redfish falling off bait trucks on commercials. They go, lobster bait, I'm not going to eat that. Of course, it isn't anymore, but it's kind of hard to turn those perceptions. So our insight was, in the seafood space, to engage all across the market space. So with fishermen, with processors, with buyers, and with grocery stores. And it's really been magic. I mean, it's hard. You know, it would be really easy to publish this little card that says you should eat this and you shouldn't eat that. But by engaging deeply in the supply chain, it really embeds this thinking across all of the institutions who are making decisions. So that's what our community group does. And then our third group, education, I think is fairly easy to understand in conventional terms. It's this business of trying to cultivate a science-literate public, trying to engage people in stuff that is personally relevant and place-based so that they really want to learn about it and it can inform evidence-based decision-making.
You are, you've been in a lot of different places doing a lot of different things. You've been part of, let's see, You've served as the principal investigator for programs funded by NASA and the U.S. Department of Commerce. You're a co-investigator for a research project funded by the National Science Foundation. You manage operations for the Cohen Center for Interactive Learning, which you described. You have a lot of different interests. And what I heard you talking about at TEDx was actually your interest in Finland and the relationship and sort of the parallels between Finland and Maine. How is it that you're finding enough to keep you interested and here?
Well, that is actually a great question, because I have among the shorter attention spans on the planet. And if you look at my employment history, I earned a degree in English and religion so I could become an aerial photographer. And from there, I started a windmill company. And from there, I co-founded a solar company. And from there, I went to work with Maine Audubon. So I've sort of jumped around, and I've tended to stay at a place for maybe 3 years. And as soon as I see a cycle repeating, and I can say to myself, oh, I've already done that once, I really don't want to do that again, I go looking for the next interesting thing. So 26 years ago, the cycle was starting up at my last employer, and these people at what was then the Gulf of Maine Aquarium were looking to hire somebody as an executive director, and I thought, foolishly, how hard could that be? I think that sounds interesting, because a bunch of my friends were involved, and I knew a bunch of the board members. So I started that up. Well, 26 years later, there is no shortage of new opportunities, and the cycle has never repeated itself. So it's a combination of both the programming, but also the institutional growth that has kept me very, very much engaged.
Why Maine?
I guess I sort of make the point that I don't have much imagination. I was born here and raised here. And it's so funny. I went to college in Pennsylvania, and I really never had a serious conversation with myself about whether I was going to come back to Maine or not. I just came back to Maine. And I just kept finding these opportunities. That part of the reason I came back, I'd been working for this aerial photographer as a summer job, and he was a physics professor at a private school in Massachusetts, and he decided to take the business full time and invited me to join him. And I thought, well, I love photography. Flying's kind of fun. I'll go do that. And from there, I just sort of, these opportunities came up. It's interesting. A lot of young people come to see me to talk about jobs, and I'm sort of famous for saying, you know, it'd be one thing in Maine if you were looking for 28 jobs, but if you're only looking for one, and you know this is where you really want to be, I'd give it a go. Because, I mean, I've never applied for a job that was advertised. They've just kind of popped up, and they've been the right thing at the right time. And my wife teases me, because she's lived all over the country and all over the world. And I just sort of, like, not seriously considering whether I'd come back to Maine or not. I've never seriously considered moving anywhere, because I'm busy and stimulated right here.
Tell me about some of the formative things that happened when you were growing up here in Maine, some of the things that might have pointed you in the direction of having this passion for the ocean.
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't actually spend that much time on the water. So, you know, my wife and I owned a boat for quite a few years until our kids got to an age where they didn't really want to be on the boat, and we had a choice of spending time with our kids or spending time on the boat, and that was a pretty obvious choice. But I did. I grew up around lakes and ponds. It was back at a time when a lot of Maine families had camps, and both sides of my family, my mother's family and my father's family, had a camp, and it was on fresh water, and we'd go to the camp, and I really loved that. And then I worked at a summer camp. I was a counselor and a tennis coach and a lifeguard. So I was always around that stuff, and I always really liked it. And one of the things I notice now, this borders on the spiritual, I suppose, I love driving up Route 1. There are people who will say, you're crazy, it's nuts, there's too much traffic, Wiscasset's all backed up, all true. But there's something about driving through Newcastle and Damariscotta with water on both sides of me that just really, really appeals to me in a visceral sort of way. So that's why I've tended to stay around this watery profession.
People who are interested in the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, it sounds like there's just so many different directions they could go in. Mm-hmm. What's one of the most interesting things to you that the Gulf of Maine Research Institute is doing right now that you think people would want to learn more about?
Well, I think an institution like ours in a place like this has a lot of responsibility around thought leadership. This is no kidding, a really difficult economic climate, and you know, in the most recent past, it has been since the end of 2008. And we really need to be finding and thinking about some new ideas. So, for instance, here's a really weird thing going on at GMRI that you would probably never think we would get to. There's a guy named Robert Noyce, who was in the Shockley lab at AT&T when the transistor was invented. And he and seven of his peers left the Shockley lab to start Fairchild. Now, Fairchild has been headquartered here in Maine for a lot of years, but people don't realize that every single semiconductor company grew out of Fairchild. It was started by Robert Noyce. And it is inspiring to me. It was a big, big idea where these people understood the physics of building integrated circuits, and at the same time, along came a market, which was the United States saying, we're going to get somebody to the moon and back safely. And those two events converged such that not only did we get people to the moon and back safely, but we had to miniaturize all this stuff to do it because the rockets couldn't lift that much weight. And now we all see the benefits. I mean, look at what your phone does. It's crazy in just a few short years. So I find it interesting to think about what is an analogy to the space race and the semiconductor revolution in the 60s. So that's something that I'm really, really excited about that you might not initially think was a business aspect at GMRI.
Why does the Gulf of Maine Research Institute need a chief innovation officer?
It ties into our neutrality. We, by a long shot, don't think we know how to do things. We don't necessarily think we know how to marshal the forces to get things done. And the first step in that, it's kind of like the Finland thing, is finding models. So for me, I draw a really hard line between innovation and invention. So invention is a brand new idea. Nobody ever thought of doing it that way. My style of innovation is to look at something that was invented for one purpose and say, if we just tweaked it that much, it could serve this purpose. So for instance, in program design, we're always looking for ways to engage young learners. Another thing that I'm really interested in is car racing. So to race cars costs a lot of money. And so we always had to find sponsors. Now, what's interesting is the sponsors of our car racing endeavors have tended to also be sponsors of programs at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. So one of our sponsors was a guy named Kevin Eastman, who grew up in Maine and co-created the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So the Ninja Turtles are everywhere. And in this particular year, he has sold $1.5 billion worth of licensed Ninja Turtle products. So I'm going, Ninja Turtles, obviously a big deal with young boys typically, and real turtles. I wonder if we could. So I knew Kevin, and we were talking one day, and he was engaged with us around car racing, but he said, I love this thing that you're doing over there for your work, and is there any way I could help? I mean, could I sign posters? And I said, well, I've sort of been thinking, and it was only the most sort of random of thoughts, that we could put this van on the road and we could develop a program where we took the Ninja Turtles and we took away their weapons and we replaced them with the tools of scientific inquiry and said, so if you want to understand turtles, this is a good way to do it. And Kevin said, oh, that's a great idea. And I said, well, would you like me to write a proposal? Because that's what we always do. And he said, well, and this was just a conversation. He said, so what would something like that cost? And I'm kind of in my head in the conversation adding up the cost of a van and hiring somebody for a couple of years and developing some content. I said, well, that'd be about $150,000. And I said, I'd be happy to write your proposal. Oh, no. He said, this is a great idea. Took out his checkbook and wrote a check to us for it. So that's the kind of thing that I really get a kick out of is repackaging something for an educational purpose when it wasn't really intended to do that. It's kind of like our Powerhouse program where engaging middle schoolers was probably not thought about in the design and installation of the hardware and software, but it turns out to be a really engaging tool.
You referred to Finland. I've referred to Finland a few times over the course of this conversation. What is it about Finland that fascinates you so much?
Well, I mean, it's like every question you ask me, there's always a story behind it. So, Finland, there was an ad in our local newspaper, the Cape Courier, 15 years ago, and it said that the South Portland Cape Elizabeth Rotary Club was looking to put together a group of people who were not Rotarians to send them to Finland for a month. And I've always had this thing about Scandinavia, and I don't know why, and as a family, we traveled there, and I just love the design and the ethos, and they just can't do ugly, and even the paper napkins are beautiful. And so my wife said, Alan, and this was when there were 1.5 people working at the Gulf of Maine Aquarium. She said, Alan, you should apply for this. I said, are you crazy? I can't take a month off. And then she played her trump card, which is, well, if you don't apply, I will. So I did, and got selected as one of 4 people to go with this Rotary leader to Finland for a month. So who knew that the purpose of the Rotary Foundation is world peace? And they do 560 of these group study exchanges every year. So they sent 5 of us to Finland for a month. And while we were there, we met 5 Finnish people who are coming back to Portland for a month. And when I got there, one of the reasons I was interested was, believe it or not, this was so long ago that we didn't all have cell phones. Maybe if you were a busy business executive, you had this crazy bag that sat on the transmission tunnel of your car. We don't have transmission tunnels anymore either. And it was really, really expensive. And it cost $1,500 and a whole bunch of money every month, but you could make telephone calls from your car. Well, when I landed in Stockholm on our way to Helsinki, everybody in the lounge is talking on cell phones. I mean, everybody. So when I got to Finland, I started doing a survey because, of course, Nokia is in Finland, and Nokia had driven this incredible ramp up for cell phones. And it turned out that about 75% of the calls that people were making on their cell phones were family related. It's raining. The football feels too wet. We're not going to have practice today. I'll be home early. Honey, could you stop on the way home and pick up a loaf of bread? And I just found that culturally interesting, because we're always interested in how and whether technology platforms can inform learning. So I kind of came back with that, and I was attentive to that, and we got to tour Nokia factory, and I was kind of thinking about whether these platforms would become widely available, which of course they did. So then kind of 8 or 9 years ago, something funny started to happen. I'd made a lot of contacts in Finland. I get back to Finland pretty much every year. And all of a sudden, there's this test called the PISA test, which tests kids from 56 countries, 400,000 kids, 15-year-olds, and Finland comes out at the top. And it's like, what the heck? This is a country of 5 million people. Why are they performing so well on these tests, which are very open-ended and are about reasoning and problem-solving and all the stuff we want to accomplish? The tests are given every 3 years, and every 3 years, Finland is either first or second, and the U.S. is 17th or 26th. The other interesting thing about Finland, when we went there for a month, we had to give these talks at Rotary clubs. We had to sort of pay the piper somehow. So we'd stand there, and of course, once you'd done the talk 6 or 7 times, it was kind of on autopilot, and I couldn't help but notice as I would gaze out the windows, I would see trees, rocks, and water. I was like, wow, this is just like Maine. And it really was. It's just 4 times the population on 4 times a very similar land area with 4.5 times the gross national product to our gross domestic product. So it's really a lot alike. The weather in Helsinki, any day of the year, it's probably within 2 degrees of the weather in Portland. They feel very, very similar. And for all of a sudden Finland to emerge as a leader in educating kids for life in the 21st century was just interesting. So I studied it a lot more and made some comparisons between Maine and Finland, and that was the basis for the TEDx talk. And of course, what's really interesting about it is Finnish teachers don't get paid quite as much as Maine teachers. They don't work as many hours as Maine teachers. They don't give the sort of standardized tests that we do, yet year after year after year after year, they get these great results. So I'm just out looking all over the place. It's not just that it's Finland, it's that Finland has proven perhaps to be the most transferable. I'm always, you know, Singapore and Japan, there's a whole bunch of countries who are doing a good job with education. They may or may not be applicable to what we're doing here in Maine, but Finland really appears to be.
Our conversation is very interesting to me because as a physician, of course, I'm involved in an institution. I'm calling it the I guess it's called the medical industrial complex by those who know. And it's having some growing pains. And I think that we really could benefit from looking at other models. Sometimes it's hard to convince people that looking at other models might be a good idea if you're thinking about changing within your institution. What advice can you give to someone like me who's looking to do this sort of thing?
Well, so let me say, first of all, that the certainly the medical industry is facing massive change, but every single institution is. Every single one. And that's kind of the thing I learn as we get to talk to more and more people, that it is absolutely essential that every industry reinvent itself, and people are working really hard at that. I don't know that I have any great advice, because I can't necessarily speak from a position of fabulous success of getting everybody to agree to do the same thing and head in the same direction. But I would just say, it's really the point you made. Be open to looking at examples and then understanding what parts of them fit and what parts of them don't fit. I mean, there are aspects of the Finnish culture that are so dissimilar to culture here in Maine that transition will never be made. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be attentive to perhaps the pieces that will fit. So I'd say be really open-minded and don't presume that there's a single solution and you can pick it up and repot it here. I've become friends with the guy who's kind of led the Finnish education revolution, and he's out giving talks now saying, don't do exactly what we do. Understand why what we do works for us so that you can understand what you need to do that will work for you. So I think if I have any advice, that's what it would be.
I think that's great advice. I'm very excited about the work that you're doing at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. I'm now motivated to go down there myself, having had two children go through your program and another one on her way through as a seventh grader. So thank you for what you're doing and for spending time here in Maine the last, I guess, 26 years. How can people find out about the Gulf of Maine Research Institute?
We do a lot of different things. So I'd say, first of all, check our website and look at what's going on. And actually, there are two things you can do. On the first Thursday of every month, we have what we call a lunch and learn, where we invite people in for an hour and a half, and I'll talk about our education programs, and our chief science officer will talk about our research programs, and our chief community officer will talk about community, and we'll serve you lunch. There actually is a free lunch. So first Thursday of every month, so just give us a call or send us an email to say, hey, I'd like to do that. And then the other thing we do is we have these monthly lectures called the Sea State Lecture Series. We're up to version 8.1 now, so we've been doing it for several years, and it happens that the topic right now is we're digging really deep into education. So we had a psychologist visiting with us a couple of months ago talking about how kids learn. So, for instance, if you wanted an adolescent to learn anything, you'd know better than to start school before 10:30 in the morning. And they're just things that adolescents are brain-wise not able to do. Their prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed. It's a great talk. Last week we had Glenn Cummings in talking about why charter schools work for some students and not for others. So I'd say two things. The lunch and learn on the first Thursday, and check our website for the Sea State Lecture Series, because while they're on education right now, they'll be about lobstering or research or slime eels or some crazy thing in the coming months. So that's two ways to learn about what we do, what's going on down there.
And your website is?
www.gmri.org.
We've been speaking with Alan Leishness, who is the Chief Innovation Officer at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Thank you for continuing to serve the state of Maine, and I'll be down to check out your facility in not too distant future.
Sounds great, Dr. Lisa. Thanks so much for having us.